Chapter 9. Tuesday. Turkish Riviera. Richard Devon took one last look over the turquoise-blue Mediterranean and breathed in the air. Soon, he would be inside a plane for 10 hours, and he wanted to sear it all into his memory. He and his Turkish counterpart usually met at the airbase in Incirlik, but İsmet Bajcar, chief of the Turkish general staff, was on vacation near Antalya. Bajcar had no intention of leaving, not even for the U.S. Secretary of Defense. So Devon had gone to him. The Turkish Riviera was a part of the country he had never seen before. It turned out to be stunning. Bajcar's villa was positioned to maximize its breathtaking view of the sea. They had lunch on the terrace, surrounded by stone pots planted with lavender. The sun was bright and strong, but the breeze off the water made for the perfect temperature. Devon understood why his colleague didn't want to break away to come meet him. While the Secretary of Defense looked like a doughy 55-year-old country club member who should have been spending more time on the treadmill and less time in the grill, Bajcar looked like a Hollywood film star. He was tall and thin, with white hair that was perfectly trimmed. His handsome, angular face was tanned and sported a pair of black-framed glasses. Out of courtesy to his American guest, he had put on a suit, but no tie. It was like being in the presence of a Turkish Cary Grant. Though Devon had seen only a houseboy, he could imagine a bevy of bikini-clad women hidden upstairs, waiting for him to leave, so that whatever party he had interrupted could continue. For lunch, Bajcar served Mediterranean swordfish with pomegranate and pistachio salad. He paired it with a 2008 Domaine Le Fleuve Pouligny Montrachet Les Folletières Première Cru. He was showing off, but considering how far Devon had come and why, it was the least he could do. The Turks had the second largest army in NATO and were an important American ally. Their military also took the threat of fundamentalist Islam seriously. 4 times since Turkey's founding, the Turkish military had stepped in to reduce the power of the Islamists in their country. Bajcar was concerned that number 5 might be around the corner, maybe even before the next election. Turkey's leader saw himself more as a sultan than a president. He was gathering powers to his office that didn't belong. Other branches of the government, which should have served as a check, had done nothing to stop him. Of concern to the military was that their president was an Islamist. Of concern to the United States was that he was an Islamist, sympathetic to ISIS. Turkey had only been putting on a show of fighting ISIS. While its president allowed the U.S. to launch bombing runs from Incirlik, he ignored the men, money, and materiel flowing to ISIS across the Turkish border. When Turkish planes flew, they didn't hammer ISIS positions, they hammered the Kurds, who were successfully fighting against ISIS. The Turks didn't want the 40 million Kurds in Syria, northern Iraq, and western Turkey to unite and form their own sovereign nation. The Turks also hated the Syrian regime, which meant they hated Russia and Iran for propping it up. They no longer thought twice about blooding the noses of the Russians or the Iranians. If a justifiable situation presented itself, they took it. Tossing lit matches into puddles of gasoline was a recipe for disaster. If the brinksmanship wasn't de-escalated, the world was going to war. All it would take was Turkey getting hit back, and then citing Article 5 of the NATO Charter. An armed attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all. The men spoke for more than 3 hours. Bajcar played his cards close to his vest. For the time being, the Turkish military was following its president's orders. That could change. More than that, Bajcar wouldn't say. He agreed with Devon that ISIS was a growing cancer. It was a cancer, though, eating a neighbor that Turkey despised. Right now, he was content to let it continue. The prospect of war with the Russians or the Iranians, though, wasn't something he relished. He shared that with Devon and suggested that instead of pressuring Turkey, The United States should focus on those nations. Anything Turkey had done had been in retaliation for something Russia or Iran had done. None of it had been unprovoked. If Russia and Iran wanted to continue their escapades in Syria, and if those escapades drifted over the border or threatened Turkish sovereignty in any way, they could expect more of the same. Turkey had a right to defend herself. Devon understood that it was a matter of national pride. He also understood that by flexing its muscles, the Turkish military was bolstering its image among the Turkish people. That would come in handy if they decided to move against the president and other powerful Islamists. A complicated chessboard was taking shape in Turkey. If the U.S. couldn't control the movements, it at least needed to know where the pieces were. Before leaving, Devon reassured his friend that whatever he chose to do, he would have the support of the United States. That level of support, though, could be dialed up or down based upon how Turkey handled ISIS and any further Russian or Iranian provocations. There was no need to read between the lines with Devon. He was always very clear when laying out what he wanted. He didn't want his words interpreted. He wanted them understood. There was a difference. Bajhar smiled. He didn't care for politicians. He liked simple, straight talk. Devon had always been honest with him. He appreciated that. And while there was only so much he could do under the current president, Bajhar assured his colleague that he would keep the lines of communication open. They enjoyed a final cup of strong Turkish coffee, accompanied by a plate of ripe figs. Then, Bajhar walked his guest out to his car. In the driveway, there were three black Range Rovers and a police escort. These days, only the President of the United States broadcast his presence abroad in a fleet of American-made vehicles. The luxury armored SUVs had tinted bulletproof glass, run-flat tires, and a host of nasty surprises for anyone foolish enough to attempt an assault on the Secretary's motorcade. In addition, Devon was accompanied by a team of switched-on, highly intense special operations personnel. After thanking Bajhar for their meeting, the Secretary of Defense climbed into the middle Range Rover, and the column rolled out of the gated driveway and headed toward the airport in Antalya. The main road wound its way downhill and then hugged the ocean. With its beaches, glitzy boutiques, and gourmet restaurants, the area reminded Devon of the French Riviera. It was easy to see why it was one of Turkey's biggest tourist draws. When they arrived downtown, the police escort raced ahead, halting traffic at intersections so the secretary could move through without stopping. Antalya was the eighth largest city in Turkey. It was a combination of Roman ruins and modern architecture, broad boulevards and narrow medieval streets. The perfect mix of the exotic and the traditional, the kind of place his wife would enjoy visiting. Depending on how Turkey handled matters going forward, he could see himself bringing her back. The motorcade had just passed a quaint outdoor cafe, its name painted in gold leaf, when two men leapt out of a parked car. They were masked and carrying AK-47s. Immediately they began firing. "Contact left! Contact left!" one of the security team members yelled. Tires squealed and gas flooded into the Range Rover's huge engines as the SUVs took evasive action. Secretary Devon was forced to the floor for his safety. Just as his head was pressed beneath the window line, he saw both of their motorcycle escort cops lying dead in the street. The agent in the forward vehicle was radioing instructions to the rest of the team, as another agent alerted headquarters that they were under assault. They made a sharp right turn, only to discover more gunmen waiting for them. Though the vehicle was practically soundproof, Devon could hear the popping of gunfire from outside and the impact of the rounds hitting his vehicle. "They're trying to funnel us," one of the agents warned, as more masked gunmen appeared at the next intersection. "Run it," another yelled, encouraging the motorcade to barrel through the gunmen. "Jesus!" Devon's driver cursed as he swerved, trading paint with and knocking the mirrors off three cars. "We have to get back to the boulevard. These streets are too narrow." Speeding into the intersection, the driver of the lead Range Rover pulled hard on the wheel and spun right into the gunfire. The shooters rained down bullets on it and succeeded in cracking its windshield. Two of them were caught beneath the undercarriage and dragged. One was dislodged, only to be run over by the vehicle right behind. It happened so fast, the driver couldn't avoid it. Devin felt his heavy Range Rover lift slightly off the ground as it crushed a gunman's body. At the next intersection, they readied for gunfire, but none came. They appeared to have left the shooters behind. The lead vehicle made a hard left. The others followed. The street was deserted, just rows of parked cars on both sides. The lead vehicle picked up speed. The others followed suit. They were halfway down the block when a series of massive car bombs detonated in unison. From a small apartment at the end of the street, Sasha Basayev captured all of it on camera. The killing of U.S. Secretary of Defense Richard Devin was going to be his most spectacular video yet, and it would be another nail in the coffin of ISIS. Chapter 10. The White House, Washington, D.C. President Paul Porter let the moment of silence go on good and long. He wanted them to move beyond shock. He wanted them angry, like he was. In the wake of the pandemic, a lot of people had changed how they viewed death. Some had suffered such tremendous loss in their personal lives that they had just become numb. The president had suffered too. He had lost friends and acquaintances, trusted confidants, and cabinet members. He had been forced to rebuild his team quickly. Everyone he had selected had come highly recommended. Some of them he had known before, some were completely new to him. Many of them were second and even third stringers, plucked from different agencies, seat fillers until a more formal team could be finally assembled. Because of his leadership and handling of the crisis, the president was enjoying the highest poll numbers of his career. Even Congress, also stocked with seat fillers who had been appointed by their state governors until the next election, was working with him. The president knew, though, that there was a limit to all the goodwill. He also knew that bad forces remained marshaled against the United States. The business of being president, of protecting the country, didn't stop, no matter how badly he needed to catch his breath. Porter looked around the table, and when he felt enough time had passed, he called the meeting of his National Security Council to order. The first person he looked at was his CIA director. "What do we have?" Bob McGee hit a button on his laptop, and the screens around the Situation Room lit up with crime scene photos. They were stamped with the logo of Turkey's General Directorate of Security. "The Turks believe that up to 10 terrorists may have been involved in the attack on Secretary Devin and his team. According to witnesses," said McGee as he advanced to a new photo, "these three were struck and killed by the lead vehicle in the motorcade. They have been identified as Abdullah Ozal, Ahmed Çiçek, and Hussein Tuzman. One worked in a pharmacy, one was a school teacher, and the third lived at a home with his parents." The chairman of the Joint Chiefs interrupted him. "Are they wearing GoPros?" "They are," replied the CIA director, as he zoomed in on one of the dead terrorists and the camera mounted to his chest. "Where's the footage? Have the Turks shared it with us yet?" "These cameras didn't have SD cards. Everything was wirelessly uploaded in real time to the cloud. The NSA is already chasing it." "But we should expect another video," said the Secretary of State. McGee nodded. "Has any group claimed responsibility? Do we know who we're dealing with?" Shortly after the attacks, multiple photographs were posted to social media showing Tuzman and maybe Çiçek fighting in Syria. "So it looks like ISIS." Once more, the CIA director nodded. "How the hell did they know the motorcade route?" the National Security Advisor asked. "How does a group like ISIS get their hands on that kind of intelligence?" "There's obviously a leak." "Obviously." And we have to assume that it could be connected to what happened in Anbar, interjected the Secretary of State.
We've considered that, McGee replied.
Everyone waited for him to elaborate, but he didn't. President Porter cleared his throat and said,
In 4 days, we've had 22 Americans brutally assassinated. One of them used to sit in this very room with us. We will not slow, we will not sleep, we will not stop until the people responsible have felt the full force of our wrath. If we have to turn over every damn rock in the Middle East until we find them, we will. But while we're turning over rocks, I want to discuss a broader strategy. For every ISIS Muslim fanatic we kill, two more pop up to take his place. How do we defeat them?
We deny them territory, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs responded. Without territory, there's no caliphate.
And how do we do that? The president asked.
Bomb the hell out of them and send in ground troops.
That's exactly what they want us to do, said the Secretary of State. We'd need a sustained force of 500,000 troops at least.
To wipe out less than 50,000 jihadists, replied the chairman.
No, for the decades of occupation afterward.
How do you figure?
ISIS is a creation of Sunni Islam. Part of its appeal is that it's a pushback against the growing Shia influence in the region. That influence is backed by Iran. You're going to end up with 25 million Syrian and Iraqi Sunnis looking for protection. If we don't fill that role, they'll run back to ISIS or something even worse.
If ISIS is a creation of Sunni Islam, said the president, how do we get the Sunnis to destroy it? You want Frankenstein to kill his own monster? The national security advisor asked.
Porter nodded.
You're asking for a complete reformation of Islam.
Christianity has had one, Judaism too, why not Islam?
Because Islam sees Muhammad as the perfect man, and the Quran a perfect copy of a perfect book in paradise. They have no history of criticism or self-examination. The word Islam itself means submission, and the word Muslim means one who submits.
The president leaned in, challenging his advisor.
So you're saying Muslims are somehow different than Jews or Christians? That they're intellectually incapable of reform? What I'm saying is that the so-called radicals are the ones practicing their faith exactly the way Muhammad wanted it practiced. The moderates are the ones who have contorted it.
The moderates are the majority, though. How do we push them to reform?
I don't know that you could, his advisor replied.
That's a cop-out. If you could wave your national security wand and have it done in a day, how would you handle it?
The man thought about it for a moment and said, Every time we've been hit by a terrorist attack, we tighten our security. That means Americans wake up the day after an attack and have less freedom. It's been the knee-jerk of every administration since 9/11. Instead of eroding American civil liberties, I'd put the pressure on the Muslim nations themselves.
How?
They profile like crazy. They have no problem with it. In fact, behind closed doors, they laugh at us for being so resistant to it. I say we turn that around on them.
The American public would be shocked to know how many foreign nationals from Muslim countries have overstayed their visas. We pause all visas for the next 12 to 24 months while we hunt them down. Do you know what an outrage that would be? The Secretary of State demanded. Do you know how badly that would damage relations with our allies in the Middle East?
We'd do a carve-out for diplomats, the National Security Advisor replied.
It doesn't matter. They'd still go ballistic.
Would the plan hurt well-intentioned, moderate Muslims?
Yes, but that's the point.
You and I can't reform Islam. Only the moderates can. And they need to be pissed off enough to get off their asses and do something about it.
But the only people these pissed-off moderates are going to be pissed off at, the Secretary of State countered, is the United States.
The National Security Advisor shook his head. Not all of them. Not the smart ones. The ones with business dealings here, and there's a lot of them, will see this for what it is. They know who the radicals in their own families are. They know which mosques are preaching radicalism,
They know who is funding it. That's where their ire will be focused. When they start coming down on the radicals in their own midst, that's when reform will be on the horizon. Or so you hope. That's the beauty of having a magic wand. I don't have to hope. I just wave it.
That's ridiculous. In fact, the entire idea is ridiculous, the Secretary of State replied. You'd be giving ISIS exactly what they want.
The president, who had been jotting notes with his chief of staff, suddenly looked up and said, That's it.
What's it?
How we defeat ISIS, Porter answered. We give them exactly what they want.
Chapter 11. The Secretary of State looked at the map on the monitors and shook his head.
I think I'd rather cancel our visa waiver program. The fallout would be minuscule in comparison.
President Porter nodded. I agree. The fallout from my idea would be massive. So massive, in fact, that something might actually get done.
And in addition to deep-sixing our diplomatic relations with every Muslim nation in the region, if not around the world, we're going to throw the Brits and the French under the bus, too.
Don't forget Israel, the National Security Advisor stated. They're going to lose their minds over this.
Israel is tough, replied Porter. They can hold their own. Even so, we'll make sure to give them an advance warning.
Can we back up here a second? The Attorney General asked. For those of us rusty on their history, would somebody unpack this?
The President enlightened him. Did you ever see the movie Lawrence of Arabia?
Years ago.
That's what this is all about. When the Ottoman Empire aligned itself with Germany and Austria-Hungary in World War I, the Brits and the French were worried that the Ottomans would cut off key shipping access and cripple their economies. They needed to get the Arabs to fight against the Ottomans, and so the Brits sent in T.E. Lawrence to convince them. They were promised everything under the sun, including Arab rule over a new united kingdom of Greater Syria. The Attorney General looked at the map on the monitors. It was from 1851 and was labeled Ottoman Syria. It encompassed present-day Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and slices of Iraq and Jordan.
There was just one problem, Porter continued. The Brits and the French never intended to honor any promises they were making to the Arabs. They'd just be trading one caliphate for another. With Russia's blessing, two diplomats, Sir Mark Sykes of Great Britain and François-Georges Picot of France, secretly formulated a plan between their governments to carve up the Middle East in the event the Ottoman Empire was defeated. It became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement and resulted in entirely new borders being drawn. It threw the region off balance, and by keeping it off balance, the Brits and the French were able to control it. This control allowed them to carve out a state for the Jewish people. This is the land ISIS wants. It's why they've also called themselves ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. What modern countries form the Levant? The president asked as he turned and pointed at the map.
Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel.
Turning back around, he said, What they want is what the Brits promised them 100 years ago. They want their Arab caliphate.
And you want to give that to them? The National Security Advisor asked.
Why?
I don't want to give these butchers anything. What I want is to put the entire damn region on notice.
You said it yourself. We can't reform Islam. Only the Islamic world can. This may be our magic wand.
If we challenge or even question the validity of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, it could destabilize the entire region. And if we walk away from it, that's it. Game over. Every single one of those governments will be overthrown.
The president looked at him. That sounds to me like a pretty good reason for them to get their acts together.
But you'd also be challenging the very validity of Israel. As soon as this fire starts burning, it'll swallow them up. Their neighbors will overrun them.
You let me worry about Israel, Porter replied. This isn't about them.
This is about forcing the hand of the Muslim nations in the Middle East to commence reform.
There's just one thing missing from your plan, the Secretary of State said. Saudi Arabia. They're not part of Sykes-Picot, but they're the very heart of Sunni Islam. Without them on board, none of this will make it past go.
The president looked at his CIA director and nodded. It was apparent that they had discussed this issue before.
We can handle the Saudis.
Excuse me?
The Secretary of State said.
You heard me.
Yeah, I heard you. What I want to know is how you plan to handle them. I've been around a long time, and I don't think I've ever heard the words handle and Saudis in the same sentence.
Well, McGee replied, you just did.
The Secretary of State looked at the President.
Sir, what the hell are we about to do?
You're going to have to trust us, Porter responded.
With all due respect, what I'm going to have to do is answer for all of this. I can't do that if I don't know what's going on.
One step at a time. First, we go after the people behind the Anbar and Antalya attacks. Then, we go after everything else.
Looking then at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the president added, I want an immediate response plan drawn up. I want to see a strike package on my desk within the next 2 hours. Who, what, where will hit in ISIS territory? The American people expect us to respond.
So does ISIS, replied the chairman.
Then let's give everyone something they'll never forget.
As the meeting broke up and people began filing out, the president's chief of staff motioned him back to the head of the conference table.
What's going on? Porter asked.
This came in during the meeting. I didn't want to bother you with it.
The president looked down at the man's laptop. Senator Daniel Wells of Iowa had not only put out a video statement about the murder of Secretary of Defense Richard Devin, but his campaign was subtly using it as a fundraising mechanism.
That's a new low, even for him, Porter said.
Normally, I'd suggest we ignore it, but this is pretty egregious.
Where'd you find it?
I use a bogus email address to subscribe to his newsletter.
So, in other words, said the president, this is only being sent to the choir.
At the moment, his chief of staff replied. But I guarantee you, all the Sunday shows subscribe to his newsletter as well.
Right now, Sunday is a lifetime away.
It may feel like that, but it isn't. Trust me.
And you need to trust me. A lot can happen between now and Sunday.
Chapter 12. Frankfurt, Germany. Tracking Sasha Basayev wasn't easy. Nicholas had done an amazing job. He had begun by searching all of the CCTV footage around the neighborhood where Salah Abaoud kept his love nest. Nothing appeared out of the ordinary, until he added an additional layer to his search. He next pulled the footage from around Salah's home and the clinic. His assumption was that the killer would have conducted cursory surveillance before making his move. His assumption was correct. But Nicholas had almost missed him. He was running a series of algorithms in the background of his search. One was an emerging piece of biometric technology called gait recognition, which measured how subjects walk. Basayev was indeed a pro. He had altered everything about his appearance. The man watching the clinic was unrecognizable from the assassin who entered the apartment building. Even the walks were different. But it was the walk that had turned out to be Basayev's undoing. Faking how you walked was one thing. Faking it consistently was something entirely different. Gait recognition technology was able to spot even the smallest changes. It was also able to look for patterns. If you were captured on camera with an inconsistent walk, it flagged you. That was how Nicholas realized the two figures he had spotted were one and the same. He had tracked a disguised Sasha Basayev to a mid-sized hotel in downtown Brussels. When Basayev emerged on camera hours later,
He was dressed in a Lufthansa uniform and accompanied by five other flight attendants. They placed their luggage in a minibus and were driven to the airport. Basayev moved through security with the other flight crew, was in and out of a couple of shops, and boarded a plane for Frankfurt. When the plane landed, Nicholas was able to reacquire the passengers and the other flight attendants, but not Basayev. He had disappeared. People didn't just disappear, especially not at a major international airport like Frankfurt, at least not without help. And so, Nicholas had dug in. Posing as a flight attendant was excellent cover. It was better than posing as a businessman. Flight attendants often received expedited screening, could hide in plain sight, and were viewed by airport staff everywhere as one of us. When the United States had learned of Basayev's existence, there'd been no mention of his cover. It was possible that the Russian intelligence defector hadn't known, or that the cover had been established later. As far as Nicholas was concerned, it didn't matter. He was on to him. He wouldn't stop until the noose was pulled so tight that Sasha Basayev couldn't breathe. To begin, he needed a name. He watched the Brussels airport footage again. Basayev had bought something in one of the shops before boarding his plane. He had paid with a credit card. It took Nicholas less than 10 minutes to get inside their system. The assassin appeared to have a sweet tooth. He had purchased 6 bars of Belgian chocolate with a Visa card. The unassuming name on the card was Peter Roth. With that name, he was able to set his sights on Belgium's Customs and Immigration Database. 2 hours later, he had a full scan of Peter Roth's German passport. Then, he went to work on Lufthansa's systems. Lufthansa owned one of the largest passenger airline fleets in the world. They served nearly 200 destinations across 78 countries worldwide. Each year, they transported more than 100 million passengers. Over 100,000 people worked for Lufthansa. 4 of them were named Peter Roth. All were based out of Frankfurt, Lufthansa's main hub of operations. Once Nicholas had access to the employee files and their photos, he was able to narrow the 4 Peter Roths to the exact one they wanted, Sasha Basayev. The noose had just tightened. He appeared to be very part-time and flew only a handful of routes, mostly international. What income Basayev did earn from Lufthansa was direct deposited into an account in Frankfurt. The address he gave as his residence was a match with 5 other Lufthansa employees. Nicholas passed it on to Harvath. It was a crash pad, or stuzu, as it used to be called. Having dated a string of Scandinavian Airlines flight attendants as a SEAL, Harvath had been in and out of several of them. It was a house or an apartment rented by a group of flight attendants who either didn't live in the city their flights were based out of, or who had traveled so much they wanted to save money by spreading the rent across multiple roommates. For Basayev, though, it would have helped layer his cover and function as a quasi-safe house. According to Lufthansa's scheduling system, he didn't have another flight on the books until next month. Was he hiding out in the apartment until then? There was only one way to find out. Parking his car at the end of the block, Harvath turned off the ignition and popped the trunk. Chapter 13. According to Nicholas, the other Lufthansa flight attendants who shared the apartment were all on active trips outside of the country. None of them were expected back tonight. Harvath had been given a street address and an apartment number. That was it. He had no idea what the interior layout looked like. He did a discreet reconnaissance, noting the entrance, exits, and which apartments had lights on. When he was ready, he picked the lock of the rear door at the parking lot and snuck inside. Pausing in the lobby, he checked the mailbox for the apartment. It was empty. Someone had recently picked up the mail. He found the stairs and walked up to the second floor. Looking at the number plates, he figured out which one he wanted. The only units he had seen from outside with lights on were at the other end of the hall. But just because he hadn't seen any lights didn't mean nobody was home. Jet lag was an occupational hazard for pilots and flight attendants. The airlines were also very strict about how many hours of sleep they were required to have before flights. Many employees invested in blackout curtains. Approaching the door, Harvath used his right hand to adjust the .40 caliber Glock 22 tucked in the sticky holster at the small of his back. The CIA had arranged for it to be left for him at a small hotel near the airport. In his left hand was a bouquet of flowers. Looking at the flight schedules of the roommates, he noted one who had been assigned at the last minute. After a quick review of her Facebook and Instagram accounts, it was obvious the attractive young woman liked to party and had a lot of male friends. It wouldn't have been a stretch to believe that she had forgotten to cancel a date before leaving on a trip. Standing outside the door, he listened for a moment. There were no sounds from inside. He knocked and waited. No one answered. He tried once more. Nothing. He tried the knob, but the door was locked. Removing his picks, he let himself in. The apartment was lit by the faint glow of the street lamps outside. He gave his eyes a moment to adjust. Setting the flowers down, he removed his Glock and began moving from room to room. The decor was sleek and minimalist. The artwork tasteful but inexpensive. It looked like an IKEA ad. The only place where any real money had been spent was in the kitchen. From the Le Creuset cookware to the expensive Japanese chef's knives displayed like museum pieces, it was obvious that someone took their cooking seriously. There was a row of cookbooks with titles in German, French, and English. In one drawer, he found a stack of food magazines. The fridge and cabinets were filled with a wide array of gourmet food items, including caviar, truffles, and foie gras. There was clothing in the closets and a smattering of personal items scattered about. But other than that, the apartment was much more hotel than home. On his second sweep, Harvath looked for places Basayev could have hidden an emergency cache. Any operative worth his salt would have kept one nearby. They usually included cash, a burner phone, or clean SIM cards and a weapon. Medical supplies, disguises, and even fake identification might be a part of it as well. It was all based upon what the operative or his organization thought was needed. Harvath was incredibly thorough in his search, but turned up nothing. If Basayev did have an oh-shit kit, it wasn't in the apartment. The entire trip to Frankfurt was a bust. It pissed Harvath off. He hated dead ends and wasted time. The best the CIA could do at this point was to wire up the apartment and sit on it. If Basayev came back, they'd need a team ready to put a bag over his head and transport him to a black site for a nice long chat. In the meantime, the CIA would also want to approach the roommates to see what they knew. Even the best operative could make a mistake. Basayev might have screwed up at some point and let something slip that might be helpful. Putting everything back exactly as he'd found it, Harvath retrieved the flowers and left the apartment. He needed to report in. The chain of command, though, was a bit murky. Technically, he worked for a private organization called the Carlton Group. Reed Carlton was an iconic spy master who had established the Central Intelligence Agency's Counterterrorism Center. He put the old in old school. After decades of faithful service, he had gotten out. He couldn't stand the careerists and the bureaucracy anymore. He saw a real future for an organization able to operate without red tape and beyond the reach of Congress. The Defense Department and the CIA turned out to be two of his best customers. They, in turn, always wanted his best operative. Carlton had taught Harvath everything he knew about the espionage business. Coupling that with his SEAL background, Harvath had vaulted to the top of the food chain. He was an apex predator, a hunter without equal. Tucked away, compartmentalized, was the man himself. He liked his work. He probably liked it too much, it cast a shadow over everything else in his life. And the problem with shadows was that it was very hard for anything to grow in the shade. He wanted the American dream, but he had been called to protect it. There were wolves, and the wolves needed to be hunted. He had a lot of hunting left in him. What he didn't have a lot left of was time to start a family. It was slipping away. He had spent his entire adult life being loyal to everyone. Everyone but himself. At some point, the torch had to be passed. At some point, he had to let someone else take his place on the wall. Not today, though. There was way too much at stake. Back in his rental car, Harvath used his encrypted phone to text the CIA's deputy director, Lydia Ryan. Ryan was Bob McGee's right hand at Langley, and, like McGee, had been an outstanding field operative, hand-picked by the president to help rebuild the Central Intelligence Agency from within. By using the Carlton Group, the CIA was able to push the boundaries of what they were legally allowed to do. It also presented them, and more important, the president, with plausible deniability if any of those actions came to light.
"Dry hole," he typed. "No sign of Pitchfork."
Pitchfork was the code name they had assigned to Basayev.
"Stand by," Ryan replied.
Several seconds later, his phone rang.
"Was it empty?"
she asked when Harvath activated the call.
"No. It's furnished and in use."
"How long since he was last there?"
"No clue. We could do a search for CCTV cameras and pull the footage if you want."
"Right," said Ryan, distracted.
"You should also put a full surveillance package on the building."
"Right."
Harvath could tell she wasn't paying attention.
"Do you want to call me back?"
"What? No. I'm sorry."
Something was up.
"What's going on?"
"More intel just came in regarding what happened in Turkey," she said.
"Turkey? What happened?"
There was a pause.
"Nobody told you?"
"Told me what? I've been in the field."
He could hear her let out a long exhalation. It sounded like air being let out of a tire.
"Defense Secretary Devon is dead," said Ryan. "His motorcade came under attack."
"Where? When?"
"Antalya, about 4 hours ago."
Harvath had known Richard Devon and had liked him. A lot. He had also known several of the men on his protective detail.
"Did anyone survive?"
"No,"
Ryan replied.
"They're all dead."
He couldn't believe it.
"How the hell did this happen?"
"We don't know. There's a lot of moving pieces. We're trying to get our arms around it."
"Who's behind it?"
"It looks like ISIS."
"Come on, Lydia," he replied. "First Anbar, and now this. ISIS isn't that good. And nobody is this lucky. Who the hell is helping them?"
"That's the question we're all asking."
There were a ton of things he wanted to say. None of them were helpful or appropriate. Holding his anger in check, he asked the only question he could.
"What can I do?"
The deputy director of the CIA didn't hesitate.
"Find Pitchfork," she said. "Fast."
Chapter 14. Oberusel, 17 kilometers northwest of Frankfurt. If Basayev was using Lufthansa as cover to move from country to country, the Russians had to have had someone inside. Harvath had charged Nicholas with figuring out who that someone was. The biggest obstacle Nicholas faced was wrapping his head around how Lufthansa booked its passengers and scheduled its crews. Once that began to crystallize for him, his search picked up speed. As someone who dealt with data, Nicholas was obsessed with patterns. Even when there was no pattern, that was a pattern, he would say. And the more he studied Basayev's travel, the more he began to figure the man out. He definitely had someone on the inside. It was someone very good at covering his tracks. Very good, but not perfect. Now that they had his employee identification number, they could track all of Basayev's Lufthansa travel as Peter Roth. That included not only his work trips, but also trips where he was traveling for free as an airline employee, or deadheading, to another destination in order to work a specific flight. There were even instances where he showed up in a foreign city somewhere and hopped onto a Lufthansa flight without any indication as to how he got there. Throughout it all, Nicholas kept looking for a constant, something that repeated itself, something that would point them to whomever the Russians had inside. Finally, he found it. Jörg Strobel was a senior IT specialist who worked in Lufthansa's crew management division. He oversaw one of the many teams that handled crew scheduling. Though he had done an intricate job hiding his involvement, he was the one behind all of Basayev's flights. But that wasn't all. Strobel's wife Anna was Bundespolizei, a uniformed federal police officer stationed at Frankfurt Airport. It looked like the Russians might have gotten 2-for-1 with the Strobels. The town they lived in was known as being a hub for tourism and IT companies. Per his file, Jörg Strobel had worked out of the Lufthansa Aviation Center at the airport until 4 years ago, when he began telecommuting from home. Anna's Bundespolizei file wasn't particularly impressive. She had graduated in the middle of her class and had spent several years protecting federal buildings before being transferred to airport duty. What was impressive about her, though, was her service photo. She was an extremely attractive woman, with straight brown hair, high cheekbones, and an enviable body that even her boxy government uniform couldn't keep hidden. She and the handsome blonde Jörg Strobel seemed made for each other. From everything Nicholas could gather, they appeared to have met at the airport. And as far as he could tell, they didn't have any children. The Strobels lived on the outskirts of Oberursel, not far from the A661 motorway. Their home was easy enough to find. The neighborhood of single-family homes was quiet. Privacy hedges separated the yards. Some houses had garages. Others had carports. Under the Strobel's carport was a new Mercedes van. The spot next to it was empty. The van seemed an odd choice until Harvath saw a ramp next to the stairs. He wondered if they were caring for an aging parent. That might explain why Jörg had begun working from home. What it wouldn't explain, though, was why he was working for the Russians. Crouching below the window line, he crept around the side of the house toward the back. There wasn't much going on. All he could see was the faint glow through one of the ground floor windows of what looked to be a television set. At the rear of the house was a small brick patio, with 3 stone steps leading up to the door. Climbing the stairs, he peeked through a window into the kitchen. Suddenly, movement caught his eye, and he pulled back into the darkness. He was still able to see into the kitchen and watched as a figure in a motorized wheelchair came into view. He was ready to have his assumption about an aging parent proven correct when he realized that it was Strobel himself. There had been nothing in the file to suggest he was disabled. Why is he in a wheelchair? And where is his wife? Harvath waited until the man had left the kitchen, and then went to work on the back door. Once he had the lock picked, he opened it slowly. The house wasn't that big, and Strobel was probably in the other room, where he had seen the TV glowing. He stepped inside and gently closed the door behind him. There was half a bottle of wine on the counter. Beside it were the remnants of packaging for a microwavable meal. From the next room, he could hear music. It was a very old recording. It took him a minute to recognize the singer, Sarah Vaughan. He took out his Glock and moved slowly, quietly toward it. At the edge of the kitchen, he could see the glow from the other room. 3 steps more, and he realized that it wasn't coming from a TV. It was coming from 3 long flat-screen computer monitors, arrayed in a semi-arc on a long table in the den. Sitting in front of them was a man who looked nothing like the file photo Harvath had seen. Jorg Strobel was thin and frail, a shadow of his former self. In his left hand was a glass of red wine. His eyes were closed as he listened to Vaughn singing "Don't Blame Me."
"Interesting choice," Harbath said, scaring the hell out of the man.
Strobel dropped his glass of wine and it shattered on the floor. He spun his wheelchair to face him.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
Harbath raised his index finger to his lips.
"Where's Anna?"
"What do you want with Anna?"
"Where is she?" he repeated.
"I don't know."
Harbath didn't believe him.
"Last chance," he said,
leveling the pistol at his chest.
"She's at work."
"When will she be home?"
The man shrugged.
"She should have been home an hour ago. Sometimes she goes out with her colleagues."
"She doesn't call you?"
Strobel used the joystick to move his wheelchair toward his intruder.
"That's close enough," Harbath warned him.
"Who are you? And what do you want with Anna?"
the man asked.
"I didn't come for Anna. I came for you, Herr Strobel."
"For me? Why for me?"
"You have been handling travel arrangements for a very dangerous man."
"A very dangerous man,"
Strobel replied with a laugh.
"You obviously have made a mistake."
"I don't make mistakes," Harbath said. "You're the man I'm looking for, and you know exactly why I'm here."
"I wish I could help you, but I cannot."
"You can help me, and you will."
"I am calling the police,"
Strobel stated, turning his chair and moving back toward his desk. Harbath grabbed a handful of the wheelchair's electrical cable and tore it out. The machine came to an immediate halt.
"You're making me angry, Jorg."
"And you have the wrong man,"
he insisted, raising his voice.
"I want you to go, now."
"Not until you tell me everything I want to know."
"I know nothing,"
the man said, averting his gaze.
"Jorg, the more you lie to me, the worse this is going to get. Believe me, your condition will not win you any special treatment. You have been aiding and abetting a killer. I want the details, all of them."
Strobel was preparing to speak, but was interrupted.
"I want the details too," said another voice.
Looking up, Harbath saw Anna Strobel standing in the doorway. She had a pistol, and it was pointed right at him. Chapter 15. Anna Strobel wasn't a great cop, but she wasn't a bad one either. Like anything else in life, police work had everything to do with timing and instinct. On her way home, she had decided to get fuel. Up ahead, she had noticed a car slow down in front of her house. It didn't stop, but whoever was driving had taken a good, long look at her property before driving off. It was enough to raise her antennae. After passing her home, the car had returned to a normal speed and turned the corner. She watched and let it drive away. Even if she had been driving an official Bundespolizei vehicle with lights and sirens, rather than her personal vehicle, she still would have needed more in order to justify a stop. Returning from the filling station, she was still bothered by the car's actions. She decided to take a roundabout way home and look for it. She found it, parked in front of a church, 2 blocks from her house. The driver was nowhere to be seen. Something was going on. One of the neighbors was traveling and had asked Anna to keep an eye on their house. She parked in their driveway and made her way through the backyards until she got to her own. There was no sign of anything wrong, but her gut told her otherwise. When she found her back door unlocked, she drew her weapon, slipped off her boots, and crept inside. She had heard the entire conversation. What bothered her even more than the intruders knowing her name was that Jorg wasn't even a good liar.
"Drop your weapon,"
she told the man holding her husband at gunpoint.
"You first," Harbath replied.
Anna leaned her shoulder forward so he could see the patch.
"Bundespolizei," she said. More officers are on the way. Drop your weapon, now.
No thanks. I'll wait until they get here.
I am not asking you. I'm ordering you. Do it now.
Harvath looked at the man in the wheelchair.
My superiors know everything, Jorg. They know why I'm here and what you've done. If the Bundespolizei become involved, it's over for you.
What is it you know exactly?
Anna asked.
Ask your husband.
She looked at Jorg, and for several moments he refused to meet her eyes. Finally he said,
Everything I did was for you.
What did you do?
I wanted to make sure you were taken care of.
What did you do?
She repeated.
It's nothing. Only a small thing.
Tell me, Jorg, now.
He was beaten, ashamed. He cast his eyes down toward the floor.
I manipulated some of the crew rosters.
Why?
For money, so that you could have the things that you need when I am gone.
Anna didn't understand.
You took money from crew members?
She replied.
For what? To arrange the trips they wanted? More vacation time?
If that's all this was, said Harvath, I wouldn't be here.
Tell me why this man is here, Jorg.
I told you, I accepted money to manipulate the rosters.
Anna looked from her husband to Harvath. She still didn't understand. Harvath laid it out for her.
He took money to help an assassin travel undetected by international law enforcement.
I had no idea that...
he sputtered.
How much?
She interrupted.
Anna, do you have to believe me that I... How much?
200,000 euros.
My God!
She responded.
200,000 euros? And you had no idea...
What?
That it was wrong? That criminals would be involved?
I am dying,
he yelled.
I did this for you.
Do not blame me. You did this for yourself, because you feel guilty. I don't need money.
Jorg Strobel laughed.
And your new car? The expensive van that accommodates my wheelchair? Where do you think those came from?
You told me you were doing IT work on the side.
And now you know the truth.
Anna fished the car key fob from her pocket and threw it at her husband. He couldn't get his hands up fast enough to catch it. The fob hit him in the chest and landed in his lap. There was an uncomfortable silence as the Strobels stared at each other. Harvath didn't have time to stand around while they worked out their issues.
How are you approached?
He asked.
Who pays you? How do you get contacted?
Strobel looked at his wife, who holstered her weapon.
I think you should answer him, she stated.
Then turning to Harvath, she said,
There are no Bundespolizei officers coming.
Harvath hadn't thought so. He had been taught how to pick out micro-expressions, the little ticks people subconsciously give off when they weren't telling the truth. She was a very good liar. Her tick was almost imperceptible.
If I talk, Jorg said to Harvath, they'll kill me. If I don't talk, you'll kill me. I don't see any upside in any of this.
If you talk, I'll protect you. You and Anna.
That was a wrinkle Jorg hadn't expected. He thought about that for a moment.
How do I know I can trust you?
You don't.
Jorg shook his head.
I don't even know who you are.
Which is how I am able to protect you,
Harvath replied.
Now. Either you start talking, or I am leaving, and taking any hope you and your wife ever have of safety with me. Your choice.
Looking up at Anna, Strobel asked,
Will you please pour us some wine?
Chapter 16 Bahnhofsviertel, Frankfurt. The neighborhood known as Bahnhofsviertel included the main railway station, as well as Frankfurt's red light district. It also included the apartment of the man who had recruited Jorg Strobel. Harvath didn't need or want Anna Strobel there, but she had insisted. She had also made a strong case for being able to authenticate the information that he hoped to extract. Zygmar Eichel worked in airport operations, and as such, he had access to terminals, runways, hangars, and every other facet of Frankfurt Airport. He could move in and out of secure areas without arousing suspicion. He knew all of the security protocols, which cameras were working, and which were down. Anna also commented that he likely could access and even alter the CCTV feeds. An added benefit of having Anna along was that she was a federal police officer. As soon as Zygmar saw her, he was going to know that it was all over for him. The trick would be in convincing him to turn against the people he was working for. Harvath hadn't expected the Russians to deal directly with Jorg Strobel. They didn't need to. They would use a go-between, or a cutout, as it was known. That was Eichel's job. He passed along the instructions, and Strobel carried them out. Eichel was higher up the food chain. As such, he would have had more training, and likely more to lose. That meant that he might end up being a harder nut to crack. Strobel had explained that he had gotten to know Eichel back when he had been working out at the Lufthansa Aviation Center. As Strobel opened up to Harvath about his medical condition, Harvath knew almost exactly how the story of his recruitment would unfold. Shortly after being diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, Eichel had begun bumping into Jorg in different places, both at work and outside the airport. It didn't happen often, but it happened often enough. Soon, the pair had struck up a friendship and were getting together for beers after work and occasionally doing things on the weekend. It usually happened, though, when Anna was on duty. She had only met Eichel once or twice. Figuring that, as a cop, she must have had a halfway decent bullshit detector, Harvath had asked her what she thought of him. Her assessment didn't disappoint. Physically, Anna remembered Eichel as being overweight and having poor eyesight and dry skin. He dressed like a man who didn't have a woman in his life and didn't want one. Personality-wise, he had an overinflated opinion of both his talent and his worth to the airport. His jokes were chauvinistic and not very clever. To top it all off, Anna detailed that Eichel wore a corrective shoe on his left foot, and that his left leg was probably shorter than his right. She commented that because of this, Eichel may have been teased as a child and have subsequently developed poor self-esteem, which resulted in his disagreeable personality and lack of interest in maintaining his physical appearance. As a final postscript, Anna noted that Eichel might just have been born an asshole, and therefore everything else was simply peripheral. Harvath had tried not to smile, but couldn't help it. She had rendered an amazingly insightful assessment and was keenly observant. Though Harvath was tempted to ask why she had missed so many things about her own husband, he didn't go there. While love could often be blind, the debilitating illness of a loved one was a no-holds-barred cage match. The blows came so fast and so furious that you were lucky to survive, much less grasp everything that was going on around you. To expect someone in the middle of an emotional tsunami to sense subtle shifts in their spouse and not chalk it up to the illness was beyond insane. Every day was a new battle. Every day you expected the unexpected. Harvath didn't blame Anna. Having been on her side of the equation before, he felt for her.
"You're not married?" she asked.
He was standing at the window of Eichel's dingy apartment near Kaiserstrasse, waiting for him to come home.
"No," Harvath replied. "I'm not married."
"Why not?"
He smiled.
"I don't know." "You don't like women?"
He laughed.
"No, I like women. That's not the problem." "Then what is it?" "I'm married to my job, I suppose."
Anna shook her head.
"That's ridiculous."
"My work is important to me."
Before leaving the house in Oberursel, Anna had changed out of her uniform into jeans, a t-shirt, and a leather jacket. Peeling off the leather jacket, she set it on the arm of the sofa and approached him.
"Do you have a woman now?"
she asked. Harvath heard alarm bells going off somewhere in the back of his mind. He'd had more than a few women. Many had walked out without even closing the door.
"I'm not sure," he replied.
"What does that mean?"
"We are going to be living in separate cities."
"But you live in the same city now?"
"No."
Anna looked at him.
"It's complicated," Harvath conceded.
She held his gaze and was about to reply when Harvath signaled for her to be quiet. He had heard something.
"Someone's coming," he whispered.
Chapter 17. Eichel kicked the door shut behind him, threw his keys in a bowl on the dining room table, and dropped a large bag of takeout food onto the coffee table. He hung his coat on a peg near the door and then walked into the kitchen. There was the sound of a fridge and a cabinet door being opened, then closed. He returned to the living room with a tall glass and a large bottle of beer. As soon as he had made himself comfortable on the couch, Harvath stepped from the bedroom. Eichel almost had a coronary.
"Scheiße!"
he gasped. Harvath pointed his Glock at him and told him to shut up.
"Who are you?" he asked. "What do you want?"
"I'm here to talk with you about Peter Roth."
"I don't know any Peter Roth," said Eichel.
Harvath smiled.
"That's not what Jörg Strobel told me."
"I don't know any Jörg Strobel."
"So, that's how this is going to go. Fine by me."
Eichel watched as Harvath produced a roll of duct tape and approached the couch. The man was already perspiring, his heart beating rapidly.
"You can't do this!" he exclaimed.
"I am doing this."
"Just tell me what you want."
"I did," Harvath said, "but you decided you wanted to play games. That's fine by me. I like games."
"I am a German citizen. You cannot do this to me."
The fat man seemed hardly in a position to be telling anyone what he could or could not be doing. When Harvath tried to secure his wrists, Eichel resisted, so he punched him in the mouth. Tears immediately formed in the man's eyes.
"Why?"
he moaned.
"You know why. And you should also know that this is only going to get more painful the more you resist me. Do you understand?"
Eichel didn't reply. So Harvath struck him again.
"Okay, enough, enough. I understand."
After securing the man's hands, Harvath asked,
"Who is Peter Roth?"
"I told you. I don't..."
Eichel began, but stopped when he saw Harvath balling his hand into a fist and cocking it back.
"Okay, okay."
"Okay what? Who is Peter Roth?"
"He works for Lufthansa."
"Who does he really work for?"
"I don't know,"
the man exclaimed. Harvath punched him again, much harder. Eichel spat a broken tooth onto the coffee table.
"You have to believe me. I don't know what any of this is all about."
Harvath drew his fist back, and Eichel shut his eyes. But instead of punching him, Harvath grabbed him by his bound wrists and dragged him into the kitchen. The last thing he needed to do was break his hand, repeatedly punching this idiot in the face. He threw Eichel down on the floor and rummaged through the cabinets until he found what he was looking for. Before the fat man could cry out, Harvath had the plastic bag over his head and had pulled it tight. Oxygen deprivation often did wonders for people's level of cooperation, not to mention recollection. Lying on top of his hands, Eichel was unable to reach up and claw at the plastic bag. As he writhed wildly on the floor, Harvath sat down on top of him, increasing the intensity of his suffocation. When he felt the man had had enough, he gave it an extra 3 seconds and then pulled the bag off his head. Eichel gasped, but couldn't get any air into his lungs until Harvath got off his back. As soon as he did, the airport operations manager sucked in air like a thirsty man at a desert oasis. No sooner had he started catching his breath than Harvath said,
"That's enough,"
and began to put the bag over his head again. Eichel shook his head vigorously from side to side.
No,
he managed to rasp.
You had your chance when I asked you about Roth, but you wanted to be a smartass. This time, the bag stays on twice as long.
Eichel thrashed even harder than before.
Please, he begged. Please, stop!
Harvath knew this game. Begging him to stop was not the same as answering his question. Eichel knew it too, so the bag went fully back over his head. As soon as it did, he began screaming a name.
Malevsky!
He yelled.
Mikhail Malevsky!
Harvath removed the bag and waited for the overweight German to begin to catch his breath. Then, rolling him into a seated position, he leaned him against the wall and said,
Who is Mikhail Malevsky?
He's Russian.
No kidding, Harvath replied. Who is he?
He's a businessman.
What kind of business?
I don't know.
Harvath grabbed a fistful of Eichel's flabby jowls and twisted.
Tell me who he is, or I put the bag back on and it doesn't come off.
Mafia,
he cried out.
Russian mafia.
Harvath let go of his face. Russian mafia could mean anything. The Russian mob was full of Russian intelligence agents. Some were retired. Some were not. All of them maintained good relations with Moscow. It was the Kremlin, after all, that put the organized in Russian organized crime.
Where do I find him? Harvath demanded.
You don't. He's very cautious. His security is the best.
We'll see about that. How does he contact you?
He texts me a code, Eichel replied. I unscramble it and then do what it says.
What else do you do for him, besides manipulating Lufthansa's crew roster?
Nothing, I swear!
He was lying. Harvath reached for the plastic bag. Eichel quickly added,
Sometimes I helped move Herr Roth through certain parts of the airport.
To avoid security or passport control?
Yes.
What else? Asked Harvath.
Sometimes it was to help him get to the private aviation area.
This got Harvath's attention.
How often did Roth fly private?
A handful of times a year.
Why not use Lufthansa?
Eichel shrugged.
I don't know.
When was the last time?
A few days ago.
Harvath looked at him.
Where did he fly to?
Turkey,
said Eichel.
Where in Turkey, specifically?
Antalya.